Now, as you would gather from our reading, and I hope from this slip of paper that you would have got as you came in this morning, you did get one, did you, as you came in? We are going to be turning to Matthew 7 over the next few Sundays when I am preaching, and that is in order that we might gather together some of the teaching, some of the vital teaching of this chapter. Matthew 7, as you will know, is of course part of the famous Sermon on the Mount which Jesus preached. And by reason of that, there is a sense in which it should never be extracted out of its background. And I hope we will see it within that general background. It might be a good thing for you to spend time in the next week or so reading through the Sermon on the Mount as the background to this particular chapter. But it does also stand alone, the seventh chapter of Matthew, as a very important part of Jesus' teaching when he instructs his disciples how to engage in a whole series of different relationships. In the NIV, for example, the chapter is divided into five paragraphs, and each of these deals with a different relationship in which as Christians we are involved. You will notice the first paragraph, which is headed in the NIV, Judging Others, is concerned with our relationship with our brother. In verse 3, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye? Verse 4, how can you say to your brother, the end of verse 5, you will be able to remove the speck from your brother's eye? There is no question that it is our relationship with our brother that Jesus is concerned with. In the second paragraph, it is with God as our Father. In the third paragraph, it is with our own destiny, that is in verses 13 and 14. He is concerned with where the kind of life we are living and the kind of commitment we have is leading us in an eternal sense, that is, where our eternal destiny will be. In the fourth paragraph, it is our relationship with false teachers or false prophets. Watch out, verse 15, for false prophets. And in verse 24, it is our relationship with Christ himself and with the words that he speaks. Now, each paragraph also focuses on one main theme. In the first paragraph, it is manifestly judgment that is the theme. In the second, prayer. In the third, enter through the narrow gate. It is commitment. In the fourth, it is fruit-bearing, that is, as a test of genuineness. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? And so on. In the last paragraph, it is obedience. Everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice. So you will see from the outline that the theme and relationship put together in each of these paragraphs produces this, that in the first we are dealing with judgment in relation to our brother. In the second, from verse 7 to verse 12, we are dealing with prayer in relation to God as our Father. In the third, verses 13 to 14, we are dealing with commitment in relation to our own eternal destiny. In the fourth, verses 15 to 23, we are dealing with fruit-bearing in relation to false prophets. And from verse 24 to the end, we are dealing with obedience in relation to Christ himself and the words he has spoken to us. This morning we turn to the first of these paragraphs, verses 1 to 6, and the theme is judgment in relation to our brother. Now, Jesus' first words in verse 1, do not judge, have a fairly wide range of meaning. from the kind of judgment given in a law court for which this word would be used, to the kind of judgment that we make of someone in a personal evaluation, where we would say, I judge that he's not a very wise man. Now the same idea is encompassed in this one word that Jesus uses. And so we need to be clear, I think, exactly what Jesus is meaning when he says these much quoted and often misunderstood words, judge not, that you be not judged, or in the NIV, do not judge, or you too will be judged. Let me say a word about what Jesus does not mean. First, he does not refer to an official judgment in a civil or criminal court. This is a person-to-person kind of encounter between two brothers, most probably Christian brothers within a Christian context. So Jesus is not speaking, as sometimes people have suggested, about the kind of judgment that takes place in a civil court. Secondly, it does not mean, and this is the deeper, more common misunderstanding, that Christians should never exercise judgment in assessing right and wrong, or truth and error. Because many people have imagined that when Jesus says, judge not, what they mean is he is telling us to suspend our critical faculties. I used to know someone who, whenever anybody said anything that was negative about another, they would immediately say, ah, now judge not. You probably had that said to you. It's the sort of thing that people will almost immediately respond with when you exercise this critical faculty God has given to us, which makes it possible for us to evaluate people or situations. Now, there are two reasons that it cannot mean that. One is that the whole teaching of the Sermon on the Mount in general requires us to exercise critical faculties and make value judgments. So Jesus is not contradicting himself within a very short space of time when he says, do not judge that you may not be judged. Because when he describes to us, for example, the kind of life we are to avoid living, like the life of the hypocrite, he means that we need to evaluate people's lives and recognize the signs of hypocrisy. And he says, do not be like them. So in the first place, it's obvious that Jesus is expecting us to exercise some kind of critical faculty when he sets before us these warnings about certain kinds of lives, and he says, do not be like that. But the other reason, which is even more obvious, is just within this chapter itself. For example, in verse 15, Jesus says, watch out for false prophets. And then he goes on to tell us how we will recognize false teachers, that is, those who have departed from the truth. And he says, watch out for them. Now, the only way that you can watch out for false teachers is to evaluate the fruit that they bear and come to a judgment or decision about them. It's impossible to do it without exercising that kind of faculty of discrimination. And Jesus says, watch out for them, don't accept them, reject them and their teaching. Or you find it even nearer than that in verse 6, if you look at verse 6, where Jesus says, do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Now, the dogs and pigs are clearly metaphors for people. And we need to be able to exercise a value judgment to see which people are represented here. So when Jesus says, "Do not give dogs what is sacred," he is expecting us to exercise a critical faculty in order that we might recognize who these people are that he is describing. We will come back to them later on. But if Jesus is not saying, never enter into civil judgment, nor saying, suspend all your critical faculties, what is he warning us against? Because it's obviously serious and important when he says, do not judge, or you too will be judged. Well, the answer obviously is, when you read the illustration that follows in verses 3-5, that what he is speaking about is not judgment, but judgmentalism or censoriousness. That attitude which is so damaging and so dangerous for Christian people to begin to adopt, and when you see it in their lives, it is a mark of a real spiritual sickness. This censorious spirit, this judgmental attitude, it is a solemn and serious thing, and Jesus is warning us against it. And we'll see in a moment that the warning is backed up with a serious threat in verse 2. But what are the marks of this censorious, judgmental spirit? Well, I think they are given to us in this remarkable, and I have no doubt for the original hearers, amusing little cameo in verses 3-5, when Jesus says, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." You see the relationship between Christian brothers and this whole question of judgmentalism. Now, my beloved, we are all of us in danger of this spirit creeping into our life and attitude, censoriousness, judgmentalism. And we need to take Jesus' warning seriously. What is it? Well, let's learn from the illustration Jesus gives to us. First, it is an attitude or spirit which is always searching for faults in other people. In other people, emphasize, it is always searching for faults in other people. Now, this is the point of the speck that's in your brother's eye and the plank that is in your own. The speck needs to be looked for, you notice. It is only seen when you're really searching for it. A speck in your eye is an unpleasant and nasty thing, but you don't go around and casually look at somebody as I would in the gallery and say, "Oh, yes, I see you've got a speck in your eye. We will need to do something about that." It's a close examination that produces that kind of assessment. And somebody really has to be looking for such a thing before they see it. And it's a fault so tiny that you have to look for it. So the spirit is often absorbed with trivia. You notice this? That this censorious spirit is often absorbed with trivial issues. and fastens upon them as though these molehills were mountains. But it is a spirit which is always searching for faults in other people. And it's eager to put the worst construction on a situation. In that sense, you will notice how it is so different from the spirit that the Apostle Paul describes to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where he says, love is always eager to believe the best. Love is never glad when others go wrong. And this spirit is always looking for something to criticize in people. Whenever you are aware of this arising in your own heart, be concerned, because in Jesus' judgment it is extremely important. Second mark of it is not only always looking for faults in other people, however trivial they may be, it is absolutely blind to its own condition. That's the point of the plank. The skelf, as we would say in Scotland, this tiny piece of wood that's in the eye of the brother, means that the person is always looking for faults in other people. The plank means that he is totally unaware of his own condition. So obsessed is he with the faults of other people that he's unaware of the huge problem he has with himself. Now, the picture Jesus paints, as I was suggesting, is intentionally ridiculous. It is the ludicrous picture of someone with a huge beam of wood in his eye, if that's possible, stopping somebody else and saying to him, my dear brother, do you realize that you have a little tiny speck in your eye? That really is a serious problem you have, and I'm the very man to put it right for you. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones, it is, who remarks, as a physician himself, here is that extraordinary medical specialist, the blind oculist. And if you think of it, it's true. Here is the blind oculist saying, I really need to do something about this problem you have in your eye. You see, this self-righteous person's blindness disqualifies him from the task that he is wanting to engage in. The beam in his own eye disqualifies him from being able to deal with the speck in anyone else's. I wonder if you remember how Jesus applies this truth in John chapter 8 with the woman who was taken in adultery. You remember the story? And the Pharisees had dragged her into Jesus' presence. We have caught her in the very act, they said. And Jesus began to write in the sand, you remember? And they pressed it upon him. Moses said, what we do with a woman like that is stone her to death. What do you say? Now, they weren't really concerned about the woman's sin. They were concerned to catch Jesus out. And they said, well, what do you say that we do? And Jesus continued to write in the sand. And they kept at him. Here she is, we caught her in the act, they say. And Jesus looks up and says, all right, we'll stone her. But we'll do it in a particular way. The first stone will be cast by whichever one of you has no sin of his own. The idea is, you see, if you've got a plank in your eye, your aim's going to be bad. So he says, the first stone will be cast by whoever has no sin. And he began to write in the sand again. And when he looked up, they had all gone. And he said to the woman, "Where are they, your accusers?" And they had all disappeared. Now, you will notice that Jesus does not say that the speck is unimportant or that the man doesn't need it taken out of his eye. He does. Something in your eye, however tiny, can be so irritating and unpleasant and difficult, you sometimes can't lead a normal life with it, and you're wanting somebody to take it out. But what he does say is that one brother needs to have clear vision to remove the other brother's speck. And that's moral vision and a moral clarity in his own life. So that's the censorious spirit. That's a difficult phrase to say, but it's the censorious spirit. What's the seriousness of it? Verse 2. In the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you again. Now, I suppose that really is true at a personal level with our other brothers and sisters, isn't it? That when you are harsh in your judgment, censorious in your spirit, and judgmental in your attitudes, other people tend to judge you by the same way that you judge them. But I don't think that's really what Jesus ultimately means. I think Jesus is really speaking about God's judgment. If you just look back, for example, to chapter 6 and to the prayer that we prayed this morning that Jesus taught us, forgive us our debts. It's at chapter 6, verse 12, as we also have forgiven our debtors. Verse 14, for if you forgive men when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their sins, your Father will not forgive you. Go further back in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 7. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the merciful. Why? For they will be shown mercy. Now the balance to this teaching is in verse 6. And I just have time to read it and look at it with you and then finish. In verse 6, Jesus sets down the balance to this teaching. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Charles Spurgeon says, our Lord tells us here that we are neither to be judges nor simpletons. And that is what Jesus is saying. He says we are neither to have this judgmental, censorious spirit, nor are we to be without discrimination and a sense of evaluation. We will come to that when we come to the false teachers in a Sunday or so. We will be recognizing that Jesus warns us against this kind of false teacher whose fruit has to be assessed and evaluated, and we need to be discriminating. It's one of the great needs in the evangelical world today, the need for discriminating wisdom, that we are not only harmless as doves, but as wise as serpents. And here Jesus, in an illustration that may be strange to us in many ways, gives us this balance of teaching. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. Now, you would need to recognize that dogs and pigs are not what we think of. We think of dogs as poodles or spaniels or some nice domesticated animal. We think of pigs as the friendly porker, but this is not the picture that Jesus is giving us. The dog in the New Testament era was a wild hound, more like a savage wolf than the kind of domesticated animal we see. That's why Jesus says they will turn around and rend you in pieces. Not only the dog, but also the pig, because the pig was more like the wild boar, which had a savage, destructive nature and was a threat to human life as well as to many others. There is little doubt that the pearls and the sacred things that Jesus refers to in verse 6 are probably the riches of the gospel. And it's a very significant thing that Jesus says, do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. You can see that the surface application of that, the superficial application, would be obviously important. This is an inappropriate thing to do. God's children are called to exercise discriminating wisdom. They are called to be wise as well as to be loving. And it is this balance which it is often so difficult for us to achieve. In the particular case, you will notice that Jesus says, do not give what is sacred to dogs. Do not throw pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. It seems very likely that these pearls, the pearl of the treasure of the gospel, the sacred things of God, are not to be taken, therefore, and indiscriminately cast around, irrespective of the response of those to whom they are given. Now you will remember Jesus himself spoke very clearly about that. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 14, for example, when he sent the 12 out, do you remember what he says? If anyone will not welcome you or listen to your words, shake the dust off your feet when you leave that home or town. He does not say, go on, continue there, keep giving them the treasure of the gospel. He says, shake the dust off your feet. I tell you the truth, it will be more tolerable or bearable for Sodom and Gomorrah on the day of judgment than for that town. I am sending you out like sheep among wolves. There is the same wild animal. You find the Apostle Paul acting in exactly the same way. For example, in Acts 18 and at verses 5 to 6, when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively, he's in Corinth, exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, notice, that's the dogs, he shook out his clothes in protest and said to them, your blood be on your own heads. I am clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. Now that leaves us all very solemn. Let me say to you, it does not mean that we do not persist with people in loving them and seeking to bring the riches of the gospel to them. It does not mean that. But it does mean that there are situations where we need to exercise this kind of discriminating wisdom and listen seriously to what Jesus says to the 12 and Paul does in relation to those who despise the gospel. John Calvin has got an interesting comment. Let me take a moment to read a bit of it to you. When he says, "Dogs and pigs are names given not to every kind of men who rebel against the gospel, or to those who are destitute of the fear of God and true godliness, but to those who by clear evidences have manifested a hardened contempt for God, so that their disease appears to be incurable." John Chrysostom uses much the same phrase when he identifies the dogs as people living in incurable godliness. I can still remember a lady in New Mills with whom I spoke so often, and I suppose I almost wept in her presence, although I don't easily weep, I may tell you. But I almost wept in her presence as I saw this bitter, bitter hardness against Christ and the blasphemy that came from her lips against the gospel. I don't think I've heard anything like it. She told me that she had been, before I went into the house that day and I told her I was coming, she had been cursing God and cursing me and cursing this foul teaching that I represented. And I remember thinking, as I said to her at the time, "I think you are in danger of damning your eternal soul finally." I never was back in her house. And I think she was the kind of person Jesus was speaking about. We probably won't often meet them, but God means us to be wise and to have this wisdom that is His. How do we get it? Well, that's the point about the next paragraph, the subject of which is prayer and our relationship with God. That's where the balance of the love of Christ and the harmlessness of the dove and the wisdom of the serpent are to be found. They are to be found in God, not in a course of counseling, but in God. And we greatly need that balance. May God in His mercy give it to us.